This is pretty crazy. We are going to start today with a look at the economic conditions that farmers anticipate into the end of the year. And then we're going to learn about NASA's agriculture division, NASA Harvest. No, guys, it's not about growing crops on Mars.
Live from the AgriSphere via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Dr. Jim Mintert from Purdue University. Then we get cosmic with representatives from NASA. Harvest. And right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. And now, the host of AgriTalk, Chip Lorre.
All right, Davis. You know, when I was talking about, mentioned that growing crops on Mars, I think there's already been a documentary about growing crops on Mars. It starred Jason Bourne, if I remember right.
I love the Jason Bourne movies. You know, and David Bowie's been singing about Mars since the 70s. So, I mean, maybe we're finally just catching up, right?
No, we're not going to be talking much about Mars today. We are going to be talking about advancing the science that is satellite imagery. That is, when we think about the derecho that blew through on August 10th and how much head scratching there has been since then, over how much damage was really done to the Iowa corn crop and some of the Illinois corn crop as well. There's got to be a better way, right? Well, that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about today with the representatives from NASA Harvest and trying to figure out and, like I said, advance the science of what it is. And get this, NASA needs everybody's help, okay? They're trying to ground truth some of this stuff, and we're going to talk about how you can participate in a study that they're doing in the derecho area. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Should be interesting. I'm really looking forward to it. And
are we smart enough to talk to these people?
Well, that's where the nervousness comes into play.
Okay, yeah, because you sound a little nervous, just unsettled. Maybe unsettled is a better word for it.
Seth Meyer from University of Missouri, FAPRI, is going to be on with Inball and Hannah.
Okay.
And I know that I can talk to Seth, and I think it's because Seth can understand what I'm saying. So maybe we'll have to use him as a translator.
Okay. Yes. Well, you've got all your ducks in a row then. That's outstanding. That's just good radio there, my friend. Good radio. Well done.
Let's get to the news.
Well, Chip, according to the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, the U.S. federal deficit for the current fiscal year will swell to $3.3 trillion. That's more than triple the shortfall recorded in fiscal 2019. The anticipated deficit would be 16% of gross domestic product. That's the largest since 1945. That was, of course, when the nation was financing World War II. Much of the red ink this year has been caused by the federal response to the coronavirus pandemic. Total government debt will surpass the U.S. economy's size next year, CBO said. Even so, the shortfall this fiscal year is smaller than the agency's April $3.7 trillion projection. Government debt will increase to $33.5 trillion by the end of 2030, or 109% of GDP. Yikes.
You know, we talked with Vince Malanga from LaSalle Economics about it earlier this week. The deficit and debtors. And right now, the federal government has decided that it does not matter. And the economy has decided that it does not matter. It will eventually, but it's not here now.
Well, we'll get Jim Mintert's look at the economy from his own perspective here. But according to the Fed's beige book, the U.S. economy is making progress toward recovery, but uncertainties remain. The central bank said, quote, economic activity increased among most districts, but gains were generally modest and activity remained well below levels prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Fed found signs of an emerging labor shortage despite elevated unemployment rates and historically high filings for jobless benefits, in particular a lack of childcare options and concerns over the impending start of remote classes in the new school year has kept many potential workers at home. Chip.
Right. Yeah, the emerging labor shortage, that might have something to do with some of the payments that were available, the add-ons to the unemployment benefits. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have been there. I'm just saying that maybe that program needs to be restructured now, take away some of that incentive of staying home and put some incentive back in there to get back into a job.
The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has lowered its global cereal grains production forecast based on expected lower U.S. corn production. FAO lowered its production forecast by 25 million metric tons, but that remains 3% above year ago. Meanwhile, the organization says food prices rose for the third straight month in August, led by coarse grains, also by vegetable oils and sugar. Dairy and meat prices were nearly unchanged during August.
Yeah.
And demand for, go ahead.
You go.
I'm just going to move on to the next one.
Yeah.
Demand for Chinese-owned state reserves chip is in decline, as just 33.6% of the corn reserves put up for auction most recently sold, marking the second consecutive auction, but only the second time auctioned corn reserves did not sell out. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
In other news, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the State Department has imposed limits on Chinese diplomats in the U.S. Under the new rule, Chinese diplomats must get prior permission to visit university campuses and hold cultural gatherings consisting of more than 50 attendees. Diplomatic social media accounts also must be designated as Chinese government controlled. Little China news for you there.
The price is going up on that corn that is being sold at the reserve auctions. Okay.
Right.
At some point, it gets to the point that imported corn is cheaper than the state-owned reserves.
Right.
So when you look at the fact that China bought more than a million tons in the first 2 days of this week of U.S. corn for delivery in the new crop marketing year, what does that tell you? It tells you that the import prices are cheaper than the auction prices right now. Okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Hey, thanks, Davis. Let's get
to
Greg Henderson,
you bet.
Editorial director at Drovers. Greg, how you doing, buddy?
Good morning, Chip. I'm great.
Good, good, good. So when we're trying to put profits in our pockets as cattle feeders, you got to have every bit of that animal making money for you. But hides are suffering a little bit, aren't they?
Yes, Chip, hides are suffering, and in fact, they're worth about 7 to 8% of the value of a steer, and about 95% of all hides produced in the U.S. go to export market. That's about a $2 billion market. Well, now we're finding out, according to a report from Steve K. Cattle Buyers Weekly, nearly 16% of all U.S. cattle hides produced last year went to the landfill. Basically, there was no market for them. The value had dropped significantly. In 2015, we were looking at hides valued at about $75 a piece. That dropped, and of course, the pandemic had an effect on it in April. They were worth only about $17 then. Right now, they're back up to about $26, but still, what's going on in the hide market, Chip, is that a lot of these furniture and shoemakers are using an oil-based synthetic, synthetic vinyls, so forth.
And when you say oil, you mean petroleum-based.
Petroleum-based, yes. I'm sorry. So one of the things the leather industry is trying to do is to get people to understand that leather is actually more environmentally friendly than these, petroleum-based products. So
absolutely.
It's a value chain that's dropping, and they're trying to do something about it.
Good, good. Yeah, we've got to have everything peeking out in value to put some money back in it. All right, Greg, thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Chip.
That's Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. We've got Jim Minchert from Purdue up next.
You're listening to AgriTalk, where the conversation begins. Join us at 855-4-TALK-AG.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Got Davis Michelson with me.
Davis.
Yeah. All right, every month, and we missed last month. We missed the update from Jim last month, but I want to get back on that, and we're going to have a conversation right now with Dr. James Minchert, ag economist, Purdue University. He's the director for Center for Commercial Agriculture there. Jim, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
Great. Good to be on the show again, Chip.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're here. Thank you so much for making time. I know you got a I know your schedule is kind of crazy right now, but thank you so much for making time. Let's get to the basic numbers, because 2 months in a row now, we've seen an increase, right?
Yeah, so the numbers did come out maybe a little more positive than I was expecting and a lot of people were expecting. We came in with an index of 144. That's up 26 points compared to last month when the reading was 118. And if you look under the hood just a little bit, the biggest thing that drove that was people became more optimistic about the future. The index of future expectations rose all the way to 154. The index of current conditions rose as well, but the big driver was the index of future expectations. People just becoming more optimistic about things down the road, feeling a little better about, I think maybe to some extent, what's going on with respect to crop production here this summer. But also, I think when we asked the question about trade, people became a little more optimistic about international trade and export prospects as well.
Okay. A dollar rally in beans, 40 cents in corn, that had to have something to do with it, didn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, a little bit broader than that, if you go back to the tail end of July, beginning of August, virtually, and then compare that to when we were collecting data, which was the third week of August, virtually all the major commodities rose in price over that time frame.
Yeah.
So you put that together with good crop prospects, and people are feeling better about it. And then, of course, USDA came out yesterday with their farm income forecast and kind of confirmed what we already thought, which is big government payments are going to provide a boost as well. So,
right. Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit here, Jim, because the government payments are making up a bigger and bigger percentage of the, hopefully I've got the right title or description on this, net farm income. It's making up a big percentage of it this year, correct?
One of the biggest, not the biggest, but certainly one of the biggest. I think my colleague Michael Langemeyer was just doing some computations on that this morning, and it looks like, based on current estimates, maybe around 36% of farm income, net farm income, in inflation-adjusted terms, coming out of government payments.
Okay. And that doesn't account for what many anticipate will be another round of payments and the willingness and the level of those government payments. Boy, don't get me wrong when I say this, everybody. Okay. But just the simple fact that the government and the Trump administration has shown such a willingness to make government payments has, It's got to be taking some of the financial stress off.
Well, that's what the data would suggest. Now, there's differential impacts, and I think if you look at a little more of the detail of USDA's presentation yesterday on some of the numbers behind the broader numbers that we're talking about, you know, they're looking at an improvement in income coming from the crop side, but a decline in the livestock side. So, you know, I think sometimes when you look at the broad brush, the big statistics like this, it makes the sector look a little more better, more optimistic or a little more positive. But when you start looking under the hood, that doesn't mean everybody in the sector is benefiting. And I think that's a key point here. So it kind of depends on who you are and what you're producing. In the aggregate, though, clearly providing a level of support we haven't seen in a long, long time. In fact, if you look at the government payment numbers, it is record large. We had a few other times in the 80s and I think what late 90s where we had some pretty large government payments, but this is going to eclipse that, and as you point out, there's a possibility of another round. So
yeah interesting. One of the numbers that I always look to in the barometer is the willingness of farmers to spend some money into the end of the year to build their business. What'd that show us?
So the Farm Capital Investment Index did rise. It rose to a reading of 65. That's up from 60 last month. And that index kind of generally kind of floats between the high 40s or maybe 50. On the high end, we've been up as high as 72, I think maybe 73 one time. But that's been a big rise going back to April. In April, that index was at 38. So 65 is a big rise relative to where we were in April. And it actually is relatively close to where we were when we peaked back in February, which was a reading of 72. And then lately here, we've been asking a follow-up question. We started doing this in the spring back in March. We asked people explicitly, what are their plans for farm machinery purchases in the upcoming year compared to a year ago? And to put that in perspective, so it's a short-run data set here. We only have information going back to March on this, so people have never been real optimistic in that time frame. But in May, 65% of the people said they were going to reduce their expenditures on farm machinery relative to last year.
Okay.
In August, that was 48%. So
Okay.
I hesitate to call that optimistic, but it's a, certainly a less pessimistic perspective than people had back in the spring.
Yeah, excellent. I get the trend there. Okay. Are there any special questions that you ask for the summer surveys?
So one of the questions that we asked this time was, in light of all the movement to online field days, conferences, et cetera,
yeah.
We asked people, first of all, have you attended one of those? And roughly one out of five people in our survey said they had attended either a virtual field day or a conference.
Okay.
And then we said, looking ahead to the fall and winter, are you interested? Do you plan to attend a virtual field day or a virtual conference? And not quite half, 44% of the people in the survey said they intended to attend some kind of a virtual educational event going forward. So that's interesting, I think, for all of us in kind of the education space and in the agribusiness space. I think it speaks to the idea that there are people looking for information in a variety of different ways, whether it be listening to, you know, AgriTalk on the radio, listening to a podcast, viewing a webinar, or still, you know, half the people, I think, maybe are interested in attending in-person educational events.
Jim, is that adoption of new technology or acceptance of the situation?
Well, I think it's a little of both, and I think the situation is probably forcing some people to adopt some technology that maybe they wouldn't have been willing to do in the past. I mean, we don't have a history here, so I don't know what the response would have been a year ago.
Interesting.
I don't think we would have got 44% saying I would attend a virtual field day a year ago. But then this year, they're saying, yeah, that could be very helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Any forward-looking indicators that you've got in the barometer that might be saying, hey, take a look at me, I'm telling you something?
Well, I think the farmland value questions are always interesting. And when we ask people about their farmland price expectations 5 years into the future, so looking at it more from a little more of an investment perspective, they became significantly more optimistic. So again, going back to May, only 40% of the people in the survey thought farmland values would rise over the next 5 years. That's been rising, not every single month, but it's been rising since then. On this last survey here in August, 59% of the people in the survey said they think farmland values are going to rise over the next 5 years. And that's the highest that's ever been going back to when we started collecting data on this question back in 17. So people became more optimistic. I think it's consistent with what we were seeing in the broader index. I think it's probably consistent with what USDA released yesterday with respect to the farm income numbers. But it doesn't mean everybody out there is doing well. We've got lots of evidence of individual operations that are struggling in this environment. But the sector is still able to support some rising asset values, it looks like.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Jim, I know that you are always, advising farmers in the state of Indiana to be aware of what's coming up next and to be prepared. What are you talking to them most about right now?
Well, I think the challenge right now, and we've got a webinar coming up just next week following the USDA's next crop production report, is to start thinking not only about what you're going to do with the 2020 crop, but what are you going to do with the 2021 crop? Mm-hmm. And I think it's tempting to ignore those opportunities that exist down the road. But I think it behooves us in this environment to be thinking not only about 2020, but be thinking about the next year. And people that did that last fall benefited very well. I think there might be some opportunities along those lines as well this time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, people certainly did not anticipate that we were going to be looking at some of the opportunities that we are looking at right now after the rally in beans, rally in corn. Look at what the milk market has done. There are opportunities that people didn't anticipate that you need to pay attention to because it could really help you out.
Well, you get an opportunity to lock in a positive margin. We're living in a world where you need to lock some of those in, right? And that's not saying you need to lock in 100% of your production, but just don't ignore those opportunities. Don't let 100% of that get away from you either.
Exactly. All right. Hey, the students need to clear a path. Jim's got to get across campus and get to class. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Chip.
All right. That is Dr. James Mintert from the Ag Economics Department there at the University of Purdue. Guys, when we come back, we are going to get into the NASA harvest, okay? NASA Harvest, and we're going to learn about the program, what their objectives are, what their priorities are, and they need some help. Stay tuned. NASA Harvest, up next on AgriTalk.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beej, another bean sale announced this morning. What's going on?
Well, China and Unknown are out there buying soybeans. There was talk of that yesterday in the soybean market on China. Weekly export sales on both corn and soybeans were strong for new crop, but nothing bigger than what was anticipated. So I was seeing a little bit of price pressure this morning just on a pullback, I think, because none of the news out there was any bigger than like I said, was anticipated. Yeah. And we just need fresh, bullish news that isn't anticipated, I think, to drive prices higher at this point.
Right. Very good. How much is weather going to have an influence on this corn market going forward, Brian?
Oh, not probably as much as it would normally. I think that what we've seen, the price rally, is the market anticipates that USDA's crop estimates are coming down in September, probably again in subsequent months after that. So they built some of that in, and harvest is quickly approaching here. It's already reached in some areas, so the weather focus probably isn't as great as what it would be in a normal year when we weren't shutting down already.
Gotcha. Okay, big pork sales announced this morning.
Yeah, China the lead buyer there, and that's really what the market needed and has been waiting on. And so big move up here, led by the front end of the market, but the back end is participating a little bit as well. The cattle market, it's under some pressure this morning. I think a large part of that's tied to the stock market, which is facing some pretty heavy pressure here, and just concerns along with the weaker cash trade again this week in the cattle market.
Gotcha. Thank you, Brian. This is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It's brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. We're not going to waste any time here. I'm Chip Flory, got Davis Michelson with me. And let's get this started with the folks from NASA Harvest. Inbal Becker Reshef joins us right now. She is the program director. Inbal, welcome to AgriTalk.
Hi, thanks, Chip. Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Very good. I want to start real quick with just a question about what NASA Harvest is, Inbal, because I'll admit I learned first about it this week, and I like to think that I kind of pay attention to what is going on in agriculture, and I'm learning about it for the first time this week. What is it?
Great. Well, we're very glad to for you to learn about our program. NASA Harvest is NASA's Applied Sciences program on food security and agriculture. Its main purpose is really to build on decades of investment from NASA in the use and developing applications of satellite data for agriculture. It's very much an applied program, really focused on agricultural monitoring, looking at different ways in which we can use satellite data for public good. And so we've got a large domestic focus, looking at anything from crop yield forecasting, crop area estimation, crop condition monitoring, and also have a large international program as well.
Right. Right. Yeah, I should have mentioned that Inbal is with the University of Maryland, where she's in the Department of Geographical Sciences, where she works with Hannah Kerner, who is an assistant research professor at the University of Maryland and is the U.S. lead on NASA Harvest. Hannah, welcome to AgriTalk.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. You're the U.S. lead, but talk about what the international reach of NASA Harvest is.
Yeah, so internationally, we're often looking at some of the same kinds of analyses that Inbal mentioned we're doing in the United States, where these methods that we're developing for looking at crop conditions or estimating crop production, we can also use, for example, to look at corn in China or wheat production in Russia or soybean production in Brazil, which is important for U.S. competitiveness and can help us learn about what's going on around the world as well as in the U.S. Domestic production. But we also have a big food security component as well.
Right. And that's what we're going to get to here in just a moment. I need to mention also that Seth Meyer is on the line with us. Seth is from the University of Missouri. He's an ag economist there with FAPRI. He's the former head of the World Board at USDA and a guest on AgriTalk frequently. How are you, Seth?
Doing great. Glad to be on with these two. And it's a fascinating subject, a technology that's only getting better.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I want to get to with you. Inbal, what are the priorities of NASA Harvest?
Sure. I think our main priority is to make sure that satellite data doesn't just stay in the research domain, but that we can really advance the technology, the applications of what it can do, and make sure that we're guided by various stakeholders, whether that's governments, whether that's humanitarian organizations, whether that's industry or farmers, but making sure that this data is converted into useful information. And so, again, whether that's looking at the impact of disasters and trying to have fairly rapid response on that, whether it's trying to give a global perspective of what crop production might look like, how are crops evolving, looking at area changes and different changes in terms of what's going on around the world, as well as looking at some sustainability issues and trying to see, you know, what is it that satellite data can provide and help advance in terms of applications.
Interesting. Okay, Seth, I got a question for you. So one of the things is to do some rapid response assessment of like the derecho storm that we had in Iowa. Is the global food balance that tight?
Well, I think so. You got to learn, right? You got to train these satellites to understand what they're seeing. So, you know, we may go in and look at the derecho, and the reality of it is the storm has an impact, but we got pretty good carryout. But now we have an expanding drought in Iowa, so that maybe even overtook the storm damage. But this is a great opportunity to learn what this looks like from space, and then that gives an opportunity for these folks to apply that in China. Are the Chinese buying all that corn because they really, really need it and the crop looks bad, or are they buying it for stocks? Or whatever.
Right.
So this is more a lessons learned. We need, you know, you need the cooperation to train the satellites to understand what you're seeing. Ground truthing.
And Hannah, that's where this headline that I saw on the site really caught my attention, calling all farmers. You're looking for some ground truthing from the derecho area, correct?
Exactly. So we have these images that we get from the satellites, and in those signals, we know that corn laying flat looks different than corn staying up. And crops that might be, you know, affected by drought will look different than crops that are very healthy. But we need the data from the ground to be able to know what those signals look like and then to map how those impacts are distributed across larger areas using the satellite data.
Okay. Inbal, is this... Is the work for predictive to be used in estimating crop size, is it for use in identifying areas where a response is needed?
Both. And so a lot of, for example, our humanitarian work will often be to anticipate, you know, or track where there's a drought, how it's impacting production, where we might be anticipating shortfalls, and give that lead time to help plan a mitigation and response. When the forecasting on yield forecasting and trying to do that as early as possible. At the same time, we're also trying to do estimates at end of season, learn from previous seasons. How do we then deal when we do get an event like this derecho, for example, so that we're ready then with the tools that we need and the models that we need to be able to be quick and have a rapid response and analysis.
Okay, which gets us back to what Hannah was talking about and the need for some ground truthing out there. Hannah, if a farmer wants to participate in this, how do they do it?
So farmers can participate by just sending us photos that you're taking on your phone that have the location enabled and emailing them to us so that we can get both a description of what we're seeing. So if we can see in the image that the corn has snapped over, for example, then we can also pair that with the location that we extract from the image to look at how that compares to what we're seeing in the satellite data. And so farmers could go to nasaharvest.org or our Twitter at nasaharvest to see the instructions on how to make sure your location is enabled on your camera, and then to send them to info@nasaharvest.org.
That is so cool. And Hannah, how, of course, farmers are going to be concerned about protecting their privacy, protecting their information. It doesn't go any further than NASA on this, right?
Absolutely not. Yeah, we are not distributing the farmer information at all. We're not distributing the photos. We're just using this to get an idea of what we're seeing in the satellite compared to what's being seen on the ground.
Right, right. Hey, Hannah, Davis has got an interesting question for us. Are you looking for just disaster pictures, or are you also looking for ground truthing from areas where the crop is good?
That's a great question. And having those examples of where the crop is looking good is almost just as important as seeing where it's not looking good, because we need to get that range of of damage effects in order to really calibrate what we're seeing in the satellite data. So, right, even if your fields have not been affected by the storm, sending us those ground truth images is also extremely useful.
Right. Seth, give me about 30 seconds on this. Are we talking about the future of crop estimation?
You know, I think we're talking about a tool that's been in the toolbox that's becoming increasingly important. Right. I mean, this is fast turnaround. You know, I talked to these two just a few days ago, and they are turning around and trying to do this analysis, a quick turnaround. It's only going to get better. There are places in the world we can't get into and observe the same way we can with mass.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Your crop tour would not be legal in China. And yet, if we can train the satellites and we can figure out what's going on, maybe we get a bit better picture of what's going on there.
Very cool. Very cool. Inball, what is the end goal for NASA Harvest? What is the mission? What are you trying to accomplish?
Sure. What we're trying to do is make sure that the data that's out there, the investments from the various space agencies are being taken up, are being used, are not just data, but are really being converted into information. And that we're developing, whether it's information that's helpful for insurance products, whether it is for forecasting what China's production is going to be, whether it's helping humanitarian organizations respond quickly or give a good sense of what happened and damage after disasters. It's really making sure that we're able to get that uptake of these data, make it available and useful for the stakeholders and end users.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you can collect all the data that you can, and I mean, it's a massive amount that you can collect, but it's not any good if you don't put it to work and put the right analysis on it, and that's what you're trying to do. I think this is fascinating. Hannah, I've got 15 seconds. Do the call to action one more time. How do people participate?
You can go to nasaharvest.org or at NASAHarvest on Twitter and learn how to make sure your location is enabled on your camera to email us your photos.
Fantastic stuff. Inball, all the way from France, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was great.
Absolutely. That is Inball Becker-Reshef. She is the program director of NASA Harvest. Hannah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I can't wait to see the photos.
Excellent. I love that. She's the U.S. lead. And Seth Meyer, University of Missouri. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you later. More AgriTalk in a moment.
America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize the Pork Checkoff for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
So just as soon as you think, yeah, I got a pretty good idea of everything that's going on in agriculture, then something like NASA Harvest comes along and you go, what?
Yep.
Been around since 2017. You guys, check it out, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's nasaharvest.org. And look at the number of people that are involved in it. Look at the quality of the people that are involved in it. How in the international connections that they have. Yep. They spell it out what the goal here is, and international food security is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. It started in 2017, so I don't feel like I've been on the outside for too long here, but it is really cool. Now, on the priority list, pay attention to it when you look at their approach, because it is an integrated approach between farmers, landowners, private industry, mm-hmm. government agencies, and it's all aimed at improved agricultural assessments so that they can turn that assessment into information that you can use so that we all can do a better job of making decisions to improve food security around the world. It's fascinating.
And I was thinking too, and I think it was Seth that brought this up, and maybe we shouldn't talk about this on the air, but being able to know, we've always been skeptical of China's numbers.
Oh, this is very true. Yeah.
If we can take a picture from up in the satellites and all that,
right,
and have, and be able to at least create our own data set on that, our own assumptions right. based on what we can observe from that data. Right. I think that would be tremendously helpful as well. And, the other thing is, I've always wondered about that. Oh, you take a picture from space. Well, what can you tell about corn from there? The idea that mm-hmm. they're now saying, yeah, we can tell the differences. We just don't always know what those differences mean from the visual. So we right. need farmers to take pictures so that we can connect that visual. Okay, well, here's this geographic location. Here's what that corn looks like on the ground. Fantastic.
Right. Right. So in the future, the survey work that needs to be done, maybe it's not just a simple question of what do you think your corn is going to average for an average yield? What are your beans going to be for an average yield? Maybe the question becomes a data point. All right. What we'd like you to do is go out and measure off 17.5 foot of corn and count all the ears in two locations in a field and provide that information back to us. From that point, then they can extrapolate, okay, average ear weights, blah, blah, blah. That's what this corn crop ought to average based on the condition. All right. And maybe we tweak that ear weight a bit based on what the satellites are showing them. The other thing that that this will help, I think, help us overcome is the agenda. All right. So okay. when we look at the market, and you brought it up, China. We always question all the information that's coming out of China, mm-hmm. and if it's coming from the state agency, we question it. And I think it should be.
Yes.
But what about CONAB?
Yeah,
the supply side agency out of Brazil. We look at that information and go, oh, yeah, hey, look at what CONAB put the crop at. It's big again. Well, mm-hmm. What that does is it supports the narrative of so many in the marketplace that have consistently said Brazilian bean production is big. It's only going to get bigger. And watch the CONAB numbers because they're going up. They're going up. They're going up. So that it fits that narrative. So nobody questions it. Nobody questions mm-hmm. it. What if we start taking a closer look at the Brazilian production based on the satellite information
right.
and saying, listen, CONAB's going up, but look at all these areas of concern mm-hmm. across Brazil. And the thing is, my attitude is about the CONAB numbers, there is an agenda on them. Of course they want them to be big because they want every importer in the world to realize that, oh, hey, if we need beans, we can just go to right. Brazil to get them.
Brazil's got them.
Brazil's the got is, them.
Yeah.
The Not only do is, they have the beans, they yeah. got corn now, too.
Yeah. And there's been so much talk about increasing the acreage and, whether that's clearing out forested acres or bringing fallowed acres back online. We can probably get a pretty good indication of how much of that, to what degree that's actually happening.
Right.
Anywhere in the world.
Right. Right. And you know, the concern is always how much rainforest, whatever, are they destroying to bring more acres into production? Or is it all the Cerrados that is, you know, I call it timber pasture for the lack of a better term.
Right.
But Cerrados to me, best way to describe it is timber pasture. So, or are they just converting timber pasture over to crop ground? You know, it's all fascinating stuff. And I only got to believe that as this technology improves, we're going to get a better idea of what is going on with production around the world, and ground truthing it is such an important step.
Because it'll take some dial in. It'll take some dial in, I would imagine.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, there is no doubt about that. All the information, data gathered. It's like I said, you can gather all the data that you can conceive of. It's mountains of data that you can accumulate, but it's the analysis and putting it to work that really matters.
You know what?
Yeah.
I've filled in for you on a number of occasions when you've gone to the Astronaut Academy and applied, and they did not accept your applications, but I'm so glad that you took that as a networking opportunity so that we can have folks like the good folks from NASA Harvest to come and be on the show with us. You know, it wasn't for nothing, buddy. Good for you. Well done.
Thank you, Davis. Appreciate that. Yeah, space camp paid off. Wow. By the way, we were talking to Isabel from France.
Yeah, all the way from Paris.
Yeah. I mean, it's
you don't have to keep him on the farm now that, you know,
no,
she's seen
absolutely
Paris.
Absolutely phenomenal to me. Hey, we've got milk prices are pushing to the upside again. We're going to find out why this afternoon. We've got Alyssa Badger, Director of Global Operations for High Ground Dairy. Tomorrow morning, got to come back. It's a free-for-all. We Smart Johnson Haney right here on AgriTalk.